Hi everyone, welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to this year's Oscars. I'm Nick Rohrkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And we are back with another episode in our Contender series. This time we'll be discussing the categories of Best Cinematography and Film Editing. I'm excited about these. I think it'll be a good continuation from last week in talking about sound, and then the next episode will also carry over a little bit into production design and some other crafts. So I'm excited about these two categories today.
Yeah, these are two of my favorite categories to talk about every year because they feel just so connected, I think, to the direction of the film. And I mean, you can really say this about any category or component of a film, but for these two, they can really make or break how I feel about a film. Editing, how you feel about how a film moves and how dynamic it is, how immersed you feel in the story. Cinematography is, you know, how the film looks, how the film is lit, how a shot is composed. I love learning about cinematographers' inspirations and how they make the decisions that they make. So I think these two categories today will be really fun to discuss. And we have some pretty great nominees here. I'm enthusiastic about quite a few of them. And we will have some great write-in votes, I think, too, because of course, a lot of great contenders were snubbed, as they are every year. So let's dig right into cinematography. Our nominees here, we have The Brutalist, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, Maria, and Nosferatu. Our guilds here, we have the American Society of Cinematographers, where we saw all of these nominees except for Emilia Perez, and the British Society of Cinematographers, where we saw four of these nominees, but we had Conclave instead of Maria. Ed Lockman, of course, though, is a branch favorite. He is our veteran of the group, our DP for Maria. But what do you think of this collection of nominees as a whole?
I think as a whole for both of these categories, I'm fairly happy with them. Obviously, we have snubs, like you mentioned, but when I think about these movies, a lot of it has to do with the framing, the blocking, the colors, the saturation, the lighting, you know, all of those elements that I think really leave a mark on you after you leave the theater and what makes you come back to a movie. I think for like Nosferatu, it's just something so different and dark and moody that for that reason alone, I would go see that movie again, despite the sound, the score, you know, all things we talked about last week and other elements of the film. And then you have a movie like Dune Part 2 that is so grand in scale that these could be tricky elements to wrangle because it's such a big undertaking. But you have someone at the helm like Greg Fraser, who has worked with Denis Villeneuve before, and they can command the space, make it feel large, but also small at the same time. So you kind of get a range of that in all of these nominees. We have the musical and Emilia Perez and having to navigate music, kind of like we talked about with sound. Yeah, it's hard to discuss some of these categories alone because they're so intertwined together. So I think overall, I like our selection here. And there are some beautiful shots in these films. What do you think?
I really like most of these. I would say my three favorites that stand above the rest are The Brutalist, Maria, and Nosferatu. You know, I'm not as big of a fan of the look of Dune Part 2. I know that's probably considered blasphemy. A lot of people are big fans of it. So I'll let you speak about your love for Greg Fraser and his work there. But when I saw Maria and Nosferatu in particular, I would say the cinematography was the defining element, really, of my experience watching both of those movies. I just kept thinking, how did they do that? How did they make that look that way, get the lighting right, really rely on natural light in some ways, or really evoke a particular period? So when I watched them, I thought about cinematography a lot. And then The Brutalist, I love the work here as well because it feels and reminds me a lot of those European films that I love from the 60s and 70s, but it also feels entirely new at the same time. I like that it has the feeling of something that you would find like a forgotten movie from another time period that would have just existed in the Van Buren archive, like something that a rich person would just have on hand. That is how I felt looking at this. It just felt so antique and period correct in the right way that I loved it. And I think drawn to the colors that are used and how each scene feels. So I would say that for me, those three really stick out.
Let's just start with our first nominee. So we have Lal Crawley here for The Brutalist. This is his first nomination. Talk about maybe what you like about some of this work. I found some really interesting facts about using handheld or Steadicam. And obviously the look of this film is very important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I really liked, first, I think that the equipment that Crawley had to use, you just mentioned Steadicam, but also shooting this in VistaVision, having this loud, heavy equipment that could be really difficult to navigate, working with all of these different types of cameras, types of lenses, that is a massive undertaking, especially for a film of this size and scope. I really liked in an article about Crawley that I read from The Hollywood Reporter that he studied a lot of brutalist architecture ahead of time to get the feel for what that would look like or how he would want it captured. But he also looked at the works of Edward Hopper and Andrew Wyeth for inspiration. So looking at modernism in particular and connecting that. And I think you can really feel that if you're familiar with those artists when you're watching this film. A lot of characters are framed in isolation or from a particular vantage point that feels very similar to the way that the subjects in Hopper and Wyeth's paintings are framed, which I really enjoyed. And I also love that he relied on natural light, and mm-hmm. you can feel that when you're watching it, just relying on nature. And that scene where Van Buren, after the party, takes everyone outside, they go up the hill, that all had to be shot in 40 minutes because of the available light source. And they wanted to specifically shoot it at that time where he said, quote, "It's supposed to feel like twilight going into night. So we couldn't have any hard sun." So they had a very limited amount of time to shoot that. And I think the glow over it, and when you see the Van Burens and all their friends walking down the hill, and then you just see Laszlo standing there by himself, I think that's such a really beautiful moment and also really indicative of the themes that are present in the film. And of course, I also just love the entire Carrara marble sequence mm-hmm. in Italy. I think that's some of the most beautiful work in the film. And the difference is that they had so much available light, and he had to work with that and decide how he wanted that to look. There's a great little featurette where Lowell describes shooting the scene in Carrara where Laszlo is dancing with that Italian woman and how the light looks. I think that's some of the most beautiful work of his in the movie, but he just walks through it and describes the lenses that he used, how he wanted to make that look, and the effect that he wanted that to have on the viewer. So yeah, I think this is really fantastic work here.
Yeah, there's so many beautiful moments from this movie. Shots alone, you have Laszlo working in the coal near the beginning. You have all of these huge structures that they capture, be it the crane or the building they're making or the Carrara mine. The list goes on and on. But I love that it's composed of all of these elements. So you have the lighting that we're talking about, the actual locations, the production design, and Judy Becker, what she did and how they collaborated together was so important for the movie. You have all of these internal spaces of minimalistic and brutalist design with these forced perspectives. I love everything they built inside, like in the Van Buren library. And then you have the framing, which is indebted to the VistaVision and allowing for this full frame that they could capture everything they wanted in these small spaces. So like when they were in the mine, allowing the light to come in, but also to be able to see Laszlo when they were restricted in certain ways. My favorite thing, I kind of hinted at this, was how they switch between handheld and Steadicam, and sometimes in the same scene. And Lal talked about the scene at the end with Erzsébet and how the use of the camera. So she comes in as handheld and it feels a little shaky. And then by the end of it, it's crazy again. And you feel that in how the scene is shot. So it's not only the action or the sound, it's literally how they are framing and shooting the scene. So I like how all of those things really come together.
Another shot I'll just mention, a favorite shot from the movie, is of course the at least semi-iconic shot of the upside down Statue of Liberty. It works, you know, on its own in the trailer and even just captured as a still, but there really is nothing like seeing that for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels overwhelming.
Well, there's more of that handheld camera as he's on the boat and he emerges and mm-hmm. he like ascends, and then you see the sky and how it all feels like one take, and then you see the Statue of Liberty upside down. That is the shot of the year, if not the decade. Another favorite one of just like the use of lighting and that twilight that you were kind of talking about was apparently it was the very last day of shooting and they had all of these things to get that they weren't able to yet. And I can't fathom getting this shot on the last day as just like a checklist thing, but it's with the sparks in front of him.
That was on the really last day.
Beautiful blue background, apparently so. And he has a cigarette in his mouth.
My God.
another really beautiful shot, and that's more of lighting and color design than maybe the framing of it, but it's, just so beautiful and crisp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One more that I'll add. There's so many we could talk about, but when they're in the cave and Van Buren is up above, he's on that balcony looking down at Laszlo, mm-hmm. and there's this shot of him from profile. The color in that, I love the greens and the reds of that scene, how deep it feels. It feels very warm, but also very scary at the same time. You get this foreboding mm-hmm. feeling. And it feels also so right for the artwork from that period, too.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, let's move on to your beloved Dune Part 2. Our DP here is Greg Fraser, who won for Dune Part 1, and this is his third nomination. What do you love about his work?
You keep saying Dune Part 2 is my movie. It is Bennett's movie, which I That's was kind true. Of surprised by.
That's true.
Dune Part 1 is my movie, and this we can call his, but I do really like the cinematography here. We talked about Part 1 on that Contender series, so I think building off of that and talking about maybe what's different, the one thing that really sticks out in my mind is the infrared, and that's something we talked about when we talked about the movie too. It was in Denis' eyes and Greg also wanting to make Gedi Prime look really different from Arrakis. And in figuring out how to do that, they decided to remove all visible light from the camera to filter all of that out so that they only captured infrared. And I love the appearance that it gives in those scenes. The characters look different. Austin Butler looks starkly white. And they also talked about in that how they had to change out some of the costume design and production design, some of the materials, because of how it looked under infrared versus visible light. So I love that. And you also see in these scenes the fireworks as ink blots, which I think is just genius work. During this moment, we see Lea Seydoux in the infrared. And one of the moments that I really love is how it transitions into the visible light. And you have this like really rich saturation that where you see the colors, the blues of her dress, the depth in the production design around her, where you kind of lose that in the infrared, which I think is also really great futuristically and making this world feel kind of off, because this is the villain we are now with as we meet Austin Butler's character. And then I think just overall in talking about Dune Part 2, I love the scale of it. And I think they really built off of Part 1 in capturing these small details with the IMAX camera, but allowing the space and the framing of that to capture the grand scale of the sandworms or the massive crowds that they have, or just the desert that feels never ending. The framing was really important because instead of the conventional widescreen format, which is more anamorphic, which is 2.39 to 1, this was totally filmed in IMAX, which is 1.43 and 1.9. So it really does give them a more almost Academy ratio scale to film, which is why when you're going to the theater and they're saying, oh, go see it in 70 millimeter, go see it in IMAX, it's because that frame is different, that you get to see more and experience more and feel like you see things a lot more clearly. So to do that, they use spherical lenses instead this time around, which they switch between in part one, and here they transition fully, which allowed that detail. There are some really cool things I think that they improved upon for this movie.
You covered a lot of great detail there. I really just enjoyed how the film has a really similar palette to the first film. So you very much know right away when the film starts that it's a continuation. This starts immediately after the first part ends, but they filmed during an eclipse. And I thought that was so, so cool how they captured that, because you can actually see that in the movie itself. And Fraser used a filter to keep the red light in, but to cut out the green and blue light. So it gives it this really haunting feel. And that's when you feel all that orange as that invades the frame. And we have, I think, one of the best scenes really in the movie is when it kicks off. Opening that way was really, really smart. And with the lighting too, if you look at behind the scenes photos of all of the structures, the palace corridor or the Cistern of Souls, when you're watching those scenes in the movie, it feels like the light is natural, like it's flowing in from outside. But then if you pull away, if you actually see the behind the scenes stills, you can see all of the unique lighting that he's rigged up to create this fake natural light, right?
I would say my favorite shot of the movie, and there are multiple, but I think the number one is in that early scene you were talking about when the Harkonnen fly off of that ridge. You're not expecting that to happen. And when they do, and that score just kind of deepens, you're just like, oh my God, we are getting something different this time around. And it just immediately captures you. And then you see them falling like these really heavy objects as they die. Oh my gosh, it's so cool. I love that sequence.
I love that too. And again, that orange light really adds to that, I think. One that I always think of is the shot when Paul and Fade Ratha are about to fight near the end. And we get the shot of them almost like they're in shadow, but they're backlit. But the backlighting is so beautiful because it looks like the sun is setting behind them and has this really warm golden glow to it. It makes it feel like something that comes from a myth or one of these old stories. And the one I mentioned on our Contenders episode with Bennett, where he said that made him cry, was the shot of Paul and Chani sitting together on the sand as it zooms out. I think that's also a really beautiful one. And then, of course, anything that we see in black and white with the infrared cameras, I think that's some of the best work really across both films that we've had so far.
Our next nominee is Emile Perez. The cinematographer is Paul Guillaume, and this is his first nomination. I think what I was most struck by reading about Paul and how he worked with Jacques is partly their inspiration. It's funny that they were inspired by another nominee here, Greg Fraser, and his work on Zero Dark Thirty. And I think how that movie and war movies in general, and then you start to talk about films set in Mexico. They also mentioned Sicario, and they really wanted to get away from this usual look that films in Mexico have lots of yellows and oranges. You can think of Traffic as well, Steven Soderbergh. And I think they really did achieve that here. This movie is so vibrant. Again, we talked about this a lot last week. There are so many colors, and we'll mention with Zoe's costumes, you know, during El Mal, so many bright reds that really make this movie shine. It, in that way, it feels very unique. And something they really wanted to do is tell this story of Emilia, obviously, but bookended by scenes at night and how the day, which is really in the core of the film, feels so different. But also nighttime itself and darkness can also feel differently. So in the beginning, we have that really intense, I would say, well-blocked scene we're introduced to dancing and singing. And then at the very end, it's this battle sequence. There's guns firing and it's an emotional moment for everyone. But he wanted that darkness to feel like death was near. So it's this transformation of Amelia, but also telling that through the setting, the lighting, and the colors of the film that you're seeing.
I like how the film uses a lot of red, too, in how the cinematography works with the production design and the costume design, and how the lighting usually feels very warm there. I also think that Guillaume plays with those big studio musicals, and also what we would think of when we think of opera, and how it always feels very dramatic with light sources that sometimes feel like spotlights, or that are these almost neon lights interacting with the characters as they're performing. The performances, I think, feel sometimes very much like they're a part of the world, but also fantastical at the same time, like those great big studio musicals. You were talking about the scene at night, and I love that Jacques Odihar gave them the instruction that the light should come from nowhere, because if you were a cinematographer and you heard that, what do you do? Truly, where do you begin? Because, and Paul Guillaume said that in this interview that with IndieWire, that as a cinematographer, as a DP, you always have a story for the light source, where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. Is it a candle? Is it coming from another room? Is it the sunlight? And here, they were just given the direction that it should feel like it's coming from nowhere. So I think they worked with that very well, clearly, and I think from the story that you described too. But I also thought it was interesting that one of his inspirations that he cited, that's something for every film that he works on, is Roger Deakins' work in No Country for Old Men. And when I was thinking about that film, I thought, oh, of course, because the lighting and how he plays with lighting inside in interiors and how sharp it feels and how bright sometimes works so well. And, you know, I don't think that the work in Amelia Perez is on the level of No Country for Old Men, but I thought that that was a really interesting inspiration to be thinking about that quality of light. And I think that I did feel that in some of the scenes in their home when Amelia is interacting with her children. And they, of course, don't know who she is or her identity. But I think that the effect of the light is similar.
I'll say for my favorite shot, I was giving Mi Camino a bad rap last episode. But I will say that that is a really cool moment in the film in terms of what you're seeing when she's singing with him and the delayed camera effect behind her, as if she's between two mirrors, kind of like that Inception-y feel. And then when they're dancing throughout that song, not in that same setting, but the lighting and how there are like pinks and purples on them, I like the composition of that moment.
Mm-hmm. That's also, I would say, the standout shot for me in the film when I was talking about how colorful it can be and how a lot of that color is coming from different light sources. That, I think, is a really a good example of that. Next, we have Maria. This is Ed Lachman's fourth nomination. His previous nominations have come from collaborations with the great Todd Haynes, of course, but this is his second nomination with Pablo Larraín. He previously worked on El Conde and was nominated for that last year. I know that you really love Maria, and the cinematography was a big reason why when we saw it. What do you love about Lachman's work here?
I'm really glad that Ed got in here because I think his work is phenomenal, and really just glancing through shots of the film, there are maybe not a ton of shots that I love, but it's just the overall appearance of the film that made me or allowed me to fall into it really well, apart from Angelina and I think the use of music, but it really is the filming and these settings that were so beautiful. He used the same lenses as he used on El Conde. So these were original Baltar lenses from the 30s. And this is also something that Jaron Blaschke used in Nosferatu that we'll talk about in a second. But this gave him that period feel and added depth that they wanted. And then along with that, they used practical lighting, which I really appreciate when they do. They used candelabra bulbs. And in order to increase the wattage, depending on how they were using them, they used Chinese lanterns to do so. So I thought that was really interesting. I think he's a master of lighting, and this is very different from Al Conde, but I appreciate throughout the film, he continued to cool the colors and increase the contrast of the camera as she neared death. So I liked how that made us envision her life really as she was reflecting on it.
Mm-hmm. I also love that he used different film stocks depending on the part of her story. He used 16 millimeter for her imagination, 35 millimeter black and white for her memories, and then 35 millimeter was for the main narrative in the story. I loved that when I was watching the film because I thought that it was a very easy way to just access those different parts of her world, but also the changing aspect ratios, playing with it sometimes like it was a film within a film, or playing with the idea that it was an opera in itself and that it followed that trajectory for the character as she was used to dying all the time. She died on stage all the time. And I think that Lorraine and Lachman really constructed this as its own form of opera, really, for her. And when I saw the film at Telluride, Lachman was there for a Q&A, and he described a few of the film's visual references. One of those is one of my favorite films, The Conformist, the Bertolucci film. And when they're in Paris, you can see that inspiration, I think, all over it, which is one of the most beautifully shot films of all time from Vittorio Storaro. But the way that the camera plays with lines and angles, I think is really, really smart. But I also thought a lot about the softness of something like Far From Heaven and the colors that are used in that film and the warmth in the lighting, and saw a lot of connections here. So I'll never complain when I think of a Todd Haynes film when I'm watching a Pablo Larraine film. I don't think that happens often, but I loved that here.
There's so much warmth too in my favorite sequence in the movie. It's this like dream sequence in the rain outside where she's wearing the kimono and she's surrounded by all of these ladies also wearing them. It's just a very dreamlike moment that you really get to see inside of her and some of the pain that she feels. But it's just captured so beautifully and elegantly. So I think there's a little bit of clashing happening, but it comes across as a really beautiful moment.
Mm-hmm. I love that too. And I think some of my favorite shots from the film are when Maria as a character is singing and she's captured in close up. I think those early shots of her in black and white are just stunning. And the film, I think, has this very editorial feel to it, almost like you were looking at a magazine from that time. And I also love the shot. It's a high angle shot where we see Maria sitting on the floor and all of her records are everywhere around her. Mm-hmm. I think that's also a really beautiful, sad moment in the film. And I love the way that it's shot.
Our final nominee is Nosferatu, with the cinematographer Jiren Blaschke. This is his second nomination. What do you like about the cinematography here?
I am so happy that Jiren Blaschke was nominated because I think this was one that was up in the air throughout the season, even though he absolutely deserved to be included. We just weren't sure what would happen with this. And he is a previous nominee, and I think just like The Lighthouse, I really love his work here. I think what really impresses me here is that there are so many scenes without lights on at all, just shot in darkness when they're in Orlok's castle. And we have to rely on just being in the dark, relying on the moonlight as it comes in through the windows, relying on the fireplace and the glow that's coming from that. And that is what Blaschke said his biggest challenge was too, looking at the script and seeing that they were in interiors and there were no lights on, how to work in that way. And I feel like what I love here is that we have episodes of Game of Thrones or other films where we just cannot see anything. They're shot in darkness, but you still can't make out any of the characters. It doesn't feel purposeful. It just feels like something is off. And here, the lighting is all so believable. And the way that he tricks you in the dark, he and Eggers, I feel like is just really masterful cinematography. He talked a lot about how in creating these scenes at night, he had to think about how the human eye would react. So he used a filter to take away any yellow and red light and also most of the green, and he just left blue instead, which made things look a particular way. So when we're seeing those blues and grays, I feel like that just creates this, you know, sinister quality, but it also makes it feel like a wintry fairy tale, something very gothic, and I love that. Eggers didn't want any red in the movie except for blood. And he had to work with the production designer and the costume designer to make sure that things that weren't red didn't look like they had red in them, or even red undertones or overtones. So I always like that too, and DPs will talk about how they collaborate with the people who are choosing the props and designing the costumes, that everything has to follow a particular look, or, you know, will be captured on film in a particular way. So I can't say enough good things, I think, about the cinematography here.
Yeah, a lot of them are in the color. When you think of the movie, apart from that final shot, you only think of shadows, blues, and blacks. And a lot of that is because of those lenses that he used and filtering out all of that other colored light to give it that desaturated monochromatic look that I really love. And part of that was also in choosing the film stock to use, in that it was a Kodak color negative film, which helped them separate the shadows. And this movie is just a masterclass in working at night, working in low light, that the film stock ended up helping him with even more. And I think that's what separates this movie from so many others this year, for me too. And some of that is in how the camera moves. I loved how he talked about his conversations with Robert Eggers in, you know, them collaborating on The Lighthouse, and how they really loved working with black and white. But then here, keeping things more classically composed in the framing. My favorite fact was how they wanted the camera to move to mimic almost as if Orlok was controlling our gaze. It was like a manipulation on his part while things still looked really classic in the frame itself.
I love that so much. And that was something I clocked when I was watching it, was how the camera was moving and how uneasy it made me feel, because sometimes you wouldn't know where Orlok was and then suddenly he would be there, or the camera would move in a way that almost felt like it was a ghost. Or it had just a strange, eerie quality to it. So I love that that was a direction.
There's one shot of Hutter in the castle, I believe. And it had this like Spike Lee dolly effect where it feels like he's just being pulled. And the camera is on that dolly too. I think that's one of those moments that I really liked. Another shot that I loved, and we've talked about this in terms of seeing those blues really intensely with that moonlight, is when he's at the crossroads and you see it, and it's that carriage coming forward and him being lured in to Orlok's presence. I think my favorite shot in the entire film is when we come outside of the window and we see his hand shadowing over the city. I think that's just a brilliant moment.
I love that one too. I love when Ellen is looking out the window and that curtain blows in and we see the shadow of Orlok. That is just, so good. But I think my favorite too is that one that I think I described it on our Best of 2024 episode. It's always the one I think of, where we just see Thomas standing in the middle of the road before going to Orlok's castle, like you described, and you just see that glow of light and gets enchanted in front of him.
I love that. Okay, so wrapping up the category here, what would your write-in vote be?
if I had to pick just one, it would be Joe Mofre's work in Nickel Boys, which I think is just absolutely staggering. Should have been here. It tells the entire story of the film, and not that cinematography doesn't in all of these other cases, but here especially, I think with that first person point of view from Elwood and then later from Turner, you learn so much about these boys from how they see an orange or a leaf or Christmas lights. I love what he does, and I think it's incredibly beautiful work that should have been recognized. And I'll also give an honorable mention to all of Sayambu Mukhtapram's movies this year. He had 4 really well-shot films: Queer, Challengers, Trap. This is my second Contenders episode mentioning Trap. I'm so sorry. And Grand Tour. All of those, despite what you think of the movies themselves, are really beautifully shot and very creative. What about you?
The real answer is Nickel Boys. I agree. That would have been my winner had it been here. But I'm going to go with Red Rooms. We'll see if I mention this movie again. But Vincent Byron, the DP there, I just think back to how uneasy I felt in that movie. And I think some of the unexpected quality to that is because of what you were watching and how he would like flip the frame over and turn it in a way in the courtroom as it zooms in on the main character. And it's just this really intense moment. So it has this very much Fincher feel to it, which I am also a fan of his cinematography. But I think that was a really chilling movie this year and something just different that I think that we wouldn't usually see in this category.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think should win?
My winner here would be Nosferatu. I would honestly like if many of these won. We have some really good work happening here, but it's Nosferatu and that darkness, that cool feeling, that something is just amiss, that entire movie that keeps you on the edge of your seat, that I really love. And in terms of his work with Robert Eggers and how their collaboration together has transformed throughout their movies, I think this would be a perfect win, and it's just one of my favorites from the year. What do you think should win?
I'm in total agreement with you. I think Nosferatu for me is the one that when I think of great cinematography in film of 2024, aside from Nickel Boys, of course, Nosferatu is the one. For all of the reasons that we discussed, the brilliance of how he plays with light and shadow to create this very specific world that also includes so many odes to the F.W. Murnau version without being a direct replica, I think is just, it's really amazing work. So I would go with Nosferatu.
Our next category is film editing. Our guild here, we have the American Cinema Editors Eddie Awards. They just announced this. This was going to be, I believe, last week, and they delayed it until after the Oscars. So our nominees here, we have Anora, The Brutalist, Conclave, Emilia Perez, and Wicked. So for Anora, our first nominee, the editor, director, writer, Sean Baker. This is his first nomination in this category, but also overall that we'll be talking about this season. He has 4 nominations, which is great.
Yeah, so I think it's so interesting listening to Sean Baker talking about his process of editing, because he's always the editor on his films. And I think some of that, I feel like if I were a filmmaker, I would have a lot of trouble handing over control to an editor. So it's really interesting hearing about his process editing the film, because he talks about how specifically the style of the scene determines how he wants the editing to be and how he wants it to feel. So I loved listening to him talk about the club scene at the beginning, which he said was found in the edit. So he wanted that to feel like a documentary. He wanted it to feel like you were just taking the camera into this club. Mikey had an earpiece, and he would tell her, okay, go over to this guy, talk to him for a little bit, and then they would move on to the next thing. And then all of that he then later found in the edit. The other piece, too, is that he had his pre-approved music, his cleared music blasting, which is a big no-no for editors from directors, where they just want it to sound clean. So then you can add the music later, but he had the music blasting because he wanted it to feel like a club.
Mm-hmm.
But he said then because of that, he had to be married to the music in the edit. So everything had to work along with how the music was playing in the club at that moment. So he kind of added a tricky layer for himself in doing that to make it feel more authentic, but I think he totally pulls it off. And then when he talks about other scenes that were much more clearly storyboarded and feel like your more traditional narrative scenes that don't have that documentary-like feel, those, he said, were actually the easiest to edit because he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He knew how he wanted them to feel. But some of those scenes that he wanted to feel like a documentary, he had to actually wait to find until later on. And I thought that was just so cool, too, because he really pulled those off. Like, they just feel very high energy. So learning that they weren't is pretty crazy.
Thinking of Anora as a documentary is crazy to me, but I love that that's how he sees his films. He talked about his process and that he takes 6 months off after shooting to distance himself from the material. I think that's really smart. You don't want to get in your head too much. And I think a lot of editors talk about that as well in terms of finding emotion and the right take and not putting yourself in between that too much. Initially, when I saw this movie, I think I was most wowed by the editing because it feels like two acts, pretty much. The first hour of the film is really fast. You're going, going, going. It's this fairy tale. And then the second half, I think, slows down a little bit. The first half is more heavily cut. The second half, you're stuck with certain characters more and longer takes that makes you feel some of the weight of what is happening. So I think he worked through it very well. I love those facts about the intro club sequence because I think you have to start out with a bang and you get to know these characters really well. It's funny and it does feel like you're in there. I love different sequences that are longer takes too, where you're walking through the club when she's coming back to find Yvonne when he's wasted. I appreciate the difference in types of filming and the editing in how Baker uses it differently throughout the film.
Next up, we have The Brutalist. Our editor here is David Jansko. This is his first nomination. What do you think of the work in The Brutalist?
I love the work here. I was worried that he wouldn't show up because he wasn't at the Guild, but I'm glad that he did show up here. He talked about the movie similarly in terms of the first and second acts and just having such a small budget and having to work through that by basically shooting longer takes and then experimenting with editing and pacing after the fact. His big thing recently is that this interview came out where he talked about using Respeecher and AI software to alter some of the sounds. And that was interesting to me because it's the editor, not like the sound mixers or any of the sound team doing that. So I think it was interesting for him to talk about that, specifically looking at editing in the film. And since he's Hungarian, he used it to help the voices sound more authentic. I think it shows just how much the editors are doing and that his job in this film and editors in general, you know, you're tackling sound with the film editing and marrying those two things, whether that's a track that you have or it's something that's live in the scene. There's also a lot to break down here. And this movie being 3.5 hours, I think it's a monstrous but a wonderful piece of film editing.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the AI thing, I think a huge piece is that, number one, the site that reported this initially, Red Shark News, uses AI to construct their interviews. So I'm a bit dubious of that and look to Brady Corbet's response, which was that, you know, the performances are all their own. Judy Becker's production design was all her own. I think what happens sometimes is that AI as a term triggers and it makes people fearful. But this example here with Respeecher or, you know, with sound related technologies is not generative AI. It's no different from, I would say, sweetening up someone's vocals in post-production in a musical, for instance, or just changing the tones of sounds. And the example that he gave, which I think is also important, is it's not English Hungarian accents. It's the voiceover from a letter being read that was just tweaked a little bit. So that to me, I'm not concerned about it. It feels very much like it was just kind of brought up to create some sort of controversy in Oscar season. I think if you want to look at a particularly evil example of AI, we will talk about Alien Romulus in visual effects and what that did to bring someone back to life effectively. So we're looking at different types of AI that are being used, and AI can be this all-encompassing term, but it's not specific. I think there are certain types of AI that we are just going to have to get used to in film, advancing technology, but this didn't take away people's jobs. People have a right to be concerned about AI and how it's used, but I also can see when I think something is incredibly blown out of proportion just to change an Oscar narrative.
Yeah, and Emilia Perez also used that same software, but I think the main narrative was around The Brutalist and not that movie, so it is a little tricky and maybe political behind that.
And thinking about The Brutalist too, another thing that he did that's also related to sound work that I thought was interesting was he actually, because the VistaVision cameras were so big and so loud, they actually had to record the sound with another camera at the same time. And that was the sound that was then used with the VistaVision image that we see. So they had to use multiple cameras. And one of the reasons why was because the VistaVision was so loud that they wouldn't be able to hear it. So again, that's another way that an editor would play with sound, right? And would work alongside a sound team. I think another highlight of the editing here is the use of archival footage, both with visuals and with sound. So we have newsreels from the past that will orient us to a particular point in time or, you know, share information about what was happening in the world at that particular time. But then I also think of the reel of Pennsylvania, for instance, when they're talking about all of the small towns in Pennsylvania and just cutting to that archival footage before we get back to where Laszlo is.
Our next nominee is Conclave with editor Nick Emerson. This is his first nomination. What do you think about the editing work here?
I actually think the editing work is really good in Conclave. And hearing Nick Emerson talk about it, his biggest challenge was that there's lots of overlapping dialogue. And that was his biggest challenge. He never wanted it to feel choppy, like you were just bouncing from character to character. And it really doesn't feel like that. And he said his biggest questions that he always had in his mind when he was editing were, where does the drama lie and whose scene is it? So just always thinking of that. Who is the central character in this scene? Who are our main players? And then also, what does Lawrence think about it? So Cardinal Lawrence being the central character, we also always needed his perspective. So in learning that and then thinking about the editing of the film, I feel like his work is pretty seamless here. It's really strong editing from going from pieces to orient us about the exposition, but also then guiding us to different characters and where they are in this drama. And it does, I think, feel like a thriller. But it's also interesting that one of Nick Emerson's North Stars as an editor was Sam Osteen. And he was the editor for films like The Graduate and Chinatown. Films that also have incredible scripts with great dialogue, where if you blink and you miss it, you might miss a particular detail. And he looked to him and his method for advice. And one of his things that he found was just to don't feel like you have to cut to go to another character to hear their line or to keep the audience engaged. You can have a long take or you can stay with a particular character. So, yeah, I think the editing is great here.
I did like his inspirations in 70s paranoia thrillers, having that feel to it, and how he talked about letting these great actors, Ralph Fiennes, Isabella Rossellini, inform the pacing and the length of the shot. What you said about not cutting too soon, it's like letting the actors breathe in that moment. And I think, you know, you do feel the intensity from the score and the action at hand and just electing a new pope, I think allowing moments to see the characters' reactions was important in not making this feel too rushed and having a natural effect with it. And there were storyboards in this case. There weren't really in The Brutalist. But I think that's another good way here to keep that intensity building as we're reaching the climax or certain big thrilling moments like in the Sistine Chapel when they're attacked.
Next up, we have Amelia Perez. Our editor is Juliet Welfling. This is her second nomination. She was previously nominated for The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. What do you think of the editing in Amelia Perez?
I think the one impressive thing with the editing here is that this movie is doing so many things at the same time that it has a lot of genre conventions to keep in mind because it's an operatic musical, because it's also a crime thriller and a family drama. Movies that work in those spaces singularly look and feel a certain way, and that also depends on the editing, but when you join them all, that's definitely a lot harder to do. And you know, we talked about with sound and flowing between dialogue and music. And so I think while it is a little showy in terms of some of the camera work in the movie, I don't think I was ever really distracted by the editing, which I think in some cases you can have whiplash if there's too much editing, but I didn't feel that in this case.
So I do think this is a case of most editing, which we do see sometimes in the editing category. What I thought was interesting in reading about her process was that this originally wasn't supposed to be a musical. So imagine coming on for this film and thinking, okay, it's going to be very different, or when you first talk about it, and then all of a sudden it's a musical and you've never cut a musical scene in a movie before. And I feel like she did a really good job. The movie does have my favorite funny transition of the entire year, which is when Rita is booking the flight to go visit the different doctors, and we get this zoom in on the credit card and this sparkle on the credit card. And then that transitions to a plane taking off. It is so funny. It's right before the Vaginoplastia song. Again, just the funniest transition. But there are moments like that that I think are absolutely ridiculous, but fit the tone of whatever is going on in this musical. And I feel like what she said with cutting a musical sequence, and she had to do that really early because Jacques saw dailies and wanted to always get to the emotion of the character. And I think you do feel that in these musical numbers, especially Zoe's in particular. You always do. I think she, of the performers, is the most successful in conveying that. But there's a lot of editing here. It's not on the level of an Adam McKay film, but there's a lot of it in a very different way from Wicked, our other musical in the category.
Well, let's talk about Wicked next. That's our final nominee, because I kind of feel a little of that when I was watching, and there are some great featurettes with the editor, Myron Kirstein. This is his second nomination, and he was previously nominated for Tick, Tick, Boom. This is his sixth collaboration with John M. Chu, but talk about the editing here a little bit and maybe how it's different from our other musical we just talked about.
I think the editing in Wicked feels just a little bit less chaotic. And I do think, though, some of the moments I have trouble with in the movie, it's a similar thing to Amelia Perez, though, where I think it's just the decision of the director that I just do not understand why certain musical scenes look like that. Why can't we spend more time watching the characters dance? But I think here the editing is much more focused on the emotion of the characters. And he talked about his favorite scene in the movie being that Ozdest ballroom sequence and wanting us to earn that emotion from Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande, their performances. Well, some of the scenes in the movie are, they have those very quick cuts. They use split screen. It is this very flashy editing. This scene is an example where I really felt like we spent a good amount of time, the right amount of time with each character, with Elphaba as she walks in to that party, and with Glinda as she has to make that choice of, you know, walking up to Elphaba and doing that odd interpretive dance with her, which I think is a really touching moment for most viewers. But I like how certain scenes are allowed to breathe like that and others feel, you know, a bit more like a music video, I'll say. I think it does move relatively quickly for its runtime.
Something that he really talks about a lot and prides himself on is following the emotion and making sure that the audience, or him in watching the dailies, really feels that emotion come across. And he doesn't want the editing to mess that up. It really needs to amplify what you're feeling on screen. And I think with Wicked, not only with your expectations with the material, but there just being so many elements and the depth that he talks about in some of his featurettes, like he really talks us through the entire Defying Gravity sequence, which is fun to watch. It's the monkeys in the background. It's the layering of the live singing. It's the score. It's the CG and the effects happening. It's so many different tracks and layers that have to come together in a sequence that has changed from 7 to 15 minutes, and you have to not feel like it's dragging. And I think there are parts of the movie that do. It is a long movie, and there's drama added to the music, different from the stage. But I do agree that I think it moves fairly well throughout. And the extra time we do spend there is done to widen the world that we live in and for us to experience more of that. This is definitely a bigger undertaking of editing and might have more than some of our other nominees, but I think overall it's a great feat of editing in a big blockbuster film and one being a musical. In wrapping up the category, what would your write-in vote be?
So again, in keeping with the spirit of not recognizing the same movies that I have before, I went with a truly out there pick here. Have you seen Hundreds of Beavers?
I did try to start watching this. I didn't really know what to make of it.
So, fair. I understand that. It is so specific. But I thought this was such a pleasant surprise. I started it, didn't think I would really care for it. But the, like, when we think of comedy editing and comedic timing, This is perfect. This was one where, because we do this contender series, every movie I watch, I make a little list of where I might mention it in the contender series. And this one, I thought, okay, I have to mention this for editing, specifically because of the gags and how the editing plays with them. So if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a bizarre, bizarre little film, but it's very funny and well made.
My write-in vote would be Challengers, of course, be it the editing of the tennis sequences, be it when things are slower in the sauna and we're cutting back between the two men, be it the POV of the ball and how that's edited together. You know, there's so much done in this movie. And I think it, while it was nominated at the Guild, you know, I really did wish it could show up here. But it's another one that the editing amps up the environment and the feel of the film. And I think that's when I'm most impressed with the film's editing work.
And what do you think should win?
I'm going to say Anora. I really love Sean Baker's work here. And the fact that he's also doing so much on the movie just shows how much vision he has and that it really became true in this film. But it's the intensity that you feel in Vegas, I think, is in large part due to the editing. And you're just so elated for this couple. And then other times in the movie, you're down in the dumps. You just are so heartbroken. And in those moments, you're forced to sit with these characters. So I love the editing there. What would you choose?
I'm going to pull a Bennett, what he did last time. I love the editing in The Brutalist. I think that the way that moves is pretty crazy. It's the shortest 3 hour and 35 minute film I've ever seen. But I'm going to go with Conclave here.
What have we become?
Maybe she has no taste, as as Reynolds Woodcock would say. It's very possible. But I feel like the editing in Conclave is really great work. It's not a film that I love, but I think it does work as this thriller. And again, thinking about how it is so character focused and we spend the right amount of time with each character, and I think does feel in a way that reminded me of some of those 70s paranoia thrillers. I don't think it's as successful as something like All the President's Men, but I do think that it feels like a throwback to something from that period, just in the way that it is edited.
Okay, we made it through two more categories. Next Contenders episode, we'll be talking about more of the crafts. We have makeup and hairstyling, costume design, visual effects, and production design. I love talking about the camera work, but we'll be filling out the frame next week and seeing all of the elements come together. Can't wait.
I love talking about these categories. We will be talking about Wicked 4 times on the next episode, so maybe watch that one ahead of the episode. But yeah, we're chipping away at these nominees. Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And you can find bonus content at patreon.com/OscarWilde. We have a poll up right now where you can help us pick our After Dark subject. So we posted some actors who were nominated: Ralph Fiennes, Guy Pearce, Zoe Saldana, Demi Moore, and Isabella Rossellini. You can vote for up to 2 who you'd like us to cover on that. So definitely go do that. And we also have updated winner predictions on our website, oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.